Great, thank you. Good morning. I'd like to begin by trying to place the context of the Madonna, the idea of the Madonna, into as large a context as possible, so that we can have a feeling of what the Madonna represents in all cultures. It's not just, you know, Sistine Madonna or whatever. It's the idea of Madonna. What does that mean? The poet Coleridge has a concept that he called interior unity, meaning that before time and space, there was a condition where there was a drama in spiritual terms having to do with the eventual evolution of the creation. And in interior unity is characterized by a particular quality, and that is, in interior unity, thinking and will are the same thing. So what is willed is also what is thought, and what is thought is also willed. But there is no there's no room for feeling. It's because what is thought happens, and what is willed is the idea. And so there's no need for feelings because everything's going according to plan. And that this is very a deep idea, because it's only in a soul that feelings can arise. There's no need for feelings in the spirit because thinking and will are the same thing. And that's a very big picture. And Coleridge calls that interior unity. And I'd like to go over this and place that idea of anterior unity, where thinking and will are one, into a context for the work today. The great drama of the Gnostics, of the Avatar. Because the work I'd like to present to you around the Madonna and the different appellations of the Madonna, the different incarnations of the Madonna, represent a path of development from ancient times through contemporary times and into the future, going from the Sophianic consciousness through the consciousness of the Madonna. An example in the esoteric schools is the Black Madonna, but there are many different versions of Madonna, but the esoteric one is the Black Madonna, and for reasons that I'll try to cover today. And then the next evolution of the Black Madonna is the being Anthropos Sophia, who is the next evolution of the Eternal Feminine. The Eternal Feminine is the soul. So the soul is sort of the fly in the ointment in the creation. And the reason why it is because it has feelings in it. And the feelings become subjective and personal rather than transcendent and impersonal. And that creates a kind of turbulence and a difficulty. And to heal the split, there's a kind of splitting. When, and in our myth, then we'll see that, the splitting creates a soul world that is embedded in a spiritual world. And the beings who live in the soul world need to once again gain access to a spiritual condition. In order to do that, they have to go through a process of purification from the negative aspects of the soul world. And the negative aspects of the soul world have to do with illusion and delusion and deception, and things where the feelings become too personalized to actually be absorbed back into the spirit. And the process of purification is called catharsis. Catharsis. And catharsis involves putting oneself through a symbolic, imaginative process into silence. To go back into interior unity. But I need, as a human, in my soul, I need to find analogs for my particular soul condition that I can use as a kind of entryway or a door into the spirit. I have to find symbols in the world that I can use and will in my imagination, so my will and my thinking start to sync with each other. And I need to take that synced will and thinking into silence. And the purpose of that is so that my feelings can be rectified, because the issue is feelings. I can't rectify my feelings with feelings. I can find where the glitch is, but I have to bring a spiritual principle to my feelings. And that involves bringing my thinking and my will back together again. When my thinking and my will come back together again, they create a kind of force in me. And that force, when they come together, is then the path from the Black Madonna to Anthropos Sophia. It's a force of freedom and love come together so that my feelings can be transcendent. When that happens, I have compassion on my failing, because I realize how small I am. That gives me a certain freedom to accept things and to surrender to the course of my life and my destiny. I begin to see my karma unfolding, etc., etc. It's a door into the spirit. And at the door, there is stationed a guardian who counsels me to do this. But if I arrive at the door uneducated or unpracticed, the guardian appears harsh. If I have practiced, the guardian says, I give the secret sign, and the guardian goes, okay, you can go, you can go, but you can only go as far as row 15. Yeah. Yeah. So that word, this is in a big, I wanted to place the myth in a larger context, and now I'll tell it as a picture, but I'll try to use the idea of antipathy and sympathy as the two soul forces. Antipathy is thinking and sympathy is will. And use those two to try to show how right from the very beginning there's a drama that results in a falling. But, and now the path back is to bring those two things together in a marriage, in an alchemical wedding. So, in the original creation, there was the Godhead in a pleroma of silence, in a fullness of silence. And we have the Creator, but the Creator without a creation is not a creator. So, the Creator, in creating, creates otherness of the creation. That's fiat. Figure one. I create. But out of the gesture, I create, there is the following gesture, it is created. And the big issue for philosophers, especially theological philosophers, for many, many years was, after the world was created, did the Creator participate in the world or withdraw? It's a very big issue. And this points to the fact that in creating, the Creator has created something that is kind of not them. We call it image. I create, but then what I create has its own kind of life. This is a dilemma of even the Godhead. Because what I've created, do I allow it to have freedom or do I control it? This is your child wanting to go on a car ride with his buddies to Tijuana when he's 18. How do I deal with this? Yeah? Is it freedom or love? Or are they, can they be the same thing? How do I deal with this? Because it's suddenly not in my control. So hidden in just the drama of the Creator and the fiat is this dilemma of the falling of the creation away from the Creator. And there are pictures the alchemists did where you'll see a kind of sun-like burst and then a dove, and in the sunburst it says fiat. And then the dove flies in a circle around and never quite completes the circle. That's the Holy Spirit. Out of fiat, the world is being created, but the circle is not complete. Okay, that's this drama. And so everything in between, there's fiat, the Creator, then the Holy Spirit is going around the periphery, and it's still open, and the center is dark, and that's the drama of the separating of thought and will in the creation. So it's a very philosophically and theologically very profound idea, and the healing of it is in the dark center is the whole issue of the Madonna, the soul, as the recipient of fiat. So the fiat principle is what we could call the male principle. It's just impulse. So those of you who are in the lower school know all about impulse from the boys. It's, you know, impulse. Why did you do that? I don't know. Seemed like a good idea. Impulse. Impulse. What were you thinking? Yes. Impulse. Okay. And then everywhere there's impulse, there is the creation that receives impulse and develops it. That's the female principle. So it has nothing to do with being a man or a woman. It just has everything to do with how my soul is organized in the spirit. The spirit is impulse, fiat, create. The soul is, I'm created. And I awaken in my createdness. But I have a memory of fiat. And so I want to sort of exercise that fiat. And then I say, this is I creating. But the question is it I or me? Is it my persona, or is it my destiny? That's where feelings come in. So I have to explore my feelings in a way that I look at them as if they were not mine. That's what we'll do today. And I use symbols as a way to do that, because I can use a symbol because it is a little less personal than my deep feelings, and I can actually, we're going to work with a process of breathing symbols. with each other and checking so that we can build an organ of perception of how the feelings are operating. That's the work I would like to do with you. So here I have God in the Pleroma of Silence, the Creator and the Created.
Figure one.
The Pleroma is the fullness of potential for the creation. And that is contained in silence. That is the healing force of the spirit, is the silence. So in all traditions, silence is the goal of the meditant. But the silence has to be structured in order for it to be productive, especially for modern people. Modern people have evolved the presence of the true self, or capital E, ego, as an evolution. And it can't be simply dissolved away. It will not dissolve away. It will find ways to come back and bite you if you try to dissolve it. Your message will be commercialized and materialized until it gets so twisted it doesn't resemble anything that you're bringing. Just surf around on the web and you'll see that's what's happening today. Okay, so here's God creating in the silence. And there are two streams now. So we have the original plan. It's still a creation, but it's closer to the original plan. But since there is a separation, there has to be an alternative to the original plan. And that alternative to the original plan is there will be beings eventually who have a soul. And the soul will be able to exist independently of the spirit because it will have its own principle of development, freedom. So the stream of the spirit goes through the sun principle, and the sun principle is an image of the Godhead, but is not the Godhead, but is the Godhead, but is not the Godhead, but is the Godhead, but... Okay, so in the reason why we can say that is because everything that is in the original creation exists out of space and out of time. And it's like the babushka dolls, you know. There's another one inside another one inside another one inside another one inside another one. And in that realm, what we experience here as space, there is intent in the thinking will. That's a hard concept, but it's everything is in everything else, except some things are a little more lined up with other things, and those are the things that have intent with each other. The stronger the intent, the more they're lined up with each other. They're like level 2 and 3 in the babushka doll rather than 2 and 28. So I remember seeing the old babushka doll. It was a big babushka and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Right on the inside, someone sent me one, a little tiny Khrushchev.
Yeah.
Little tiny one. It was a really funny picture. Okay, so we have this spiritual stream still has this kind of separating, but there is kind of, you know, not to be irreverent, but there's kind of ace in the hole. And the ace in the hole is the sun principle who will be held back from the falling of the creation as a kind of fail-safe. The holding back until the drama of the soul unfolds to a point where it's absolutely needed, and then the sun principle will emerge to turn it back around. So that principle is the experience of the I. And according to Rudolf Steiner, the original purpose of the I in the great plan was to be an oscillator in all of the hierarchies. An oscillator is kind of a rectifier. kind of a part in the system that can entrain the vibrations up and down and make things work out. And the oscillation, according to Steiner's picture, was that the original purpose of the I being was to have oscillate between two states of consciousness. And the one state of consciousness was I am an I. Individuation. And that state of consciousness would separate me from the creation. Because I am an I. And so the original purpose of that was to create this possibility of soul. But then the oscillation in the I being was that immediately upon the recognition, I am an I, would be the recognition that all other I's have exactly the same experience. So the thing that separates me from everybody else is the thing that unites me with everybody else. So this is the Christ picture of I am an I, but you and I, you know, where two or more are gathered in my name, I am there in the midst of them. And all these ideas are like, wow, how's that happen? So the oscillation between my experience of me waking up to my I and saying I am an I, the original intent was immediately to have the experience, oh, all I's are united in that experience. And then, oh, but I am an I. Oh, yes, but we're all united in that. And to oscillate between them as a kind of rectifier for the creation. That's the function of the 10th hierarchy, the human hierarchy. It's to oscillate between those two states as a kind of bring all the vibrations through that space and rectify up and down and allow a kind of a valve in the creation.
Is the presence of Mercury related to that?
It's a Mercury, yes. Yeah. So one of the mystery names of the Christ is Mercury, the healing. So this I experience is held, and then because there's been a separating out, there's a kind of breaking of the integrity of the great mystery. So there's another separating out in the Holy Spirit to be a container to hold the mystery in perpetuum, you know, forever. To hold the mystery. Because the mystery is self-perpetuating. And without mystery, we're done as humans. And so it's said among certain esotericists about natural science. The natural science seeks to solve the mystery, but the alchemists sought to reveal the mystery. They don't want to solve the mystery because that exhausts the mystery. And the mystery is the thing that keeps us fresh. So as we go along, we'll look at that idea.
So that's where symbols are helpful, because symbols have this dual quality of revealing and veiling.
And veiling, yeah, absolutely. That's why the symbols have the dual quality, revealing and veiling, and I can nurture them in myself to get an extract from them, like putting an old ham hock bone in some pea soup, you know, it just eventually just kind of permeates things. I can steep myself in a symbol through time, and it begins to reveal different aspects to me through time. It becomes a kind of guide for my work. And yet I never exhaust it because I keep just moving around it. That's the purpose of the symbol. Thank you. That's very good. So that's what we could call the spiritual stream out of the Godhead. And that is sort of has a fail-safe and a container for the mystery, has integrity. But the other stream is the soul stream, where the creation, the created creation, goes through a process of descent. And that then is the work of the hierarchies, and in Gnostic language, that's the eons, the creative beings who are working out of the impulse of the fiat. And as they pick it up and become inspired by it and move through, the creation falls closer and closer and closer to the end of the lawfulness of the creation, and closer to the opportunity for the soul world to become independent of the creation. And that becomes embodied then through all the aeons into the last aeon in Gnostic thought, the Sophia. And then the Sophia has the experience of being divorced from the Godhead, from the Creator God, from the Son as the image of the Creator God, and from the Holy Spirit, from the radiance of that vision. And there's a yearning that grows in Sophia as a kind of receptacle for the wisdom of all of the creation of the aeons. And the yearning then is an alien element in the spiritual context, because everything else in the spiritual context is filled with the ideas of the creation. In Gnostic language, an idea is a particular hierarchy, a hierarchical being. The ideas, like we say, the curiosities, the ideas. And so that consciousness of the Sophianic holding of the creative impulse of the creation is then the wisdom of the Sophia. Sophia is wisdom, the wisdom of the creation. But within that, then, in Gnostic thought, is a yearning of being divorced from the creation. So we could say in Sophia lives the question, does the Creator live in the creation or retire back? And that question is a kind of falling, because the mystery gets great and creates a yearning in Sophia. And she realizes, she meaning the developmental quality, the eternal feminine, developmental, not impulse, but development, the developmental quality of this soul stream on that side makes it necessary for Sophia to cast off what later, when it falls, will become desire. Yearning is one thing, desire is another. Desire is a little more toxic than yearning. And so when the desire falls, that becomes then the Sophia, but the Akimov, or Pistis. So I found then Pistis means faith, and faith in the tradition is knowledge. How do you go? Knowledge?
Trust.
Knowledge, trust, and action. That's the definition of faith. Knowledge, trust, and action. Thinking, feeling, willing. That's beautiful. Thank you for that. Knowledge, trust, and action. That's the Akimov. So what was a unity in thinking and willing has now become a trinity with this middle realm of the feelings that suddenly is a kind of openness of that falls out of the realm of the Creator, because it's free. It can't be monitored, so to speak. There's a fail-safe, because we still have the kind of fail-safe of the principle of the I as a rectifier, and yet the creation has to groaneth and travaileth now. You know? Sorry, that's what it says in the rental agreement. So... for your vehicle. So now it's fallen, and now other members of the hierarchies get caught up in soul drama. And the great being of Lucifer, the carrier of light, the carrier of knowledge, gets caught up in feeling, what we could say, the difference between feeling and self-feeling, inflation, and imprisons the Achamoth and surrounds her with Lucifer's version of the creation as a demiurge. Lucifer as a world creator, a demiurge, creates a version of the creation that falls out of the spirit into the soul realm, and the principle behind it is not I am and then I wake up in you or everyone else, but I am me, which is different than I am an I. And as soon as it's I am me, then it's difficult for me to say, well, you are me, because I'm pretty clear that you're not me. So I lose sight of the I in you, because all I can see is the me in you, and you are not me. So we have feelings around my me-ness that are different from my feelings of myself as a transcendent I being with a destiny that goes between lifetimes. My inner experiences, I have to have a lot of marbles before the game ends so I can win.
You've been talking about that relative to I and me and you. I and me and you. I'm just wondering, where's the world in this?
You.
Oh, we should say something else.
Yes, well, unfortunately. So everything that is not me is the world. That's the drama. And Lucifer creates that by saying, if I create a world where everything is not you, you can have a deep experience of your own self. That's Lucifer. We call it inflation or pride.
Where does desire fit in again?
The what?
Desire.
We'll go there. Okay? Where does desire fit in is the question. So if I, and that was created by Lucifer's belt of lies, which is the illusion through sense experience that everything in the created world is separate from me.
And it's interesting that it's so clever because we have iPhones and iPods on my face.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah, don't get me started on that one. We'll end up on planet I somewhere, yeah. Right. The great danger is we think that that's bad. It's just something we have to awaken to the what it really is. Because this drama goes right back to Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel is another version of me, not me. And Adam and Eve. And.
Just a quick clarification, because with the I can any second right now go into the I, which separates from you, which judges you, are you interesting, is that making sense? Or I can go in the I, which connects me with all you try to involve, be at the same time in the same, so which I are you talking about?
So the operant word is I can. The question is, do I? It's a question of will. So when I say, oh, I can go into myself and experience my I or you, the question is, do I personally know which in me is the difference? I can't answer that for you or anyone else. I can only answer that in myself. Because the thing that prevents me from answering that is my feelings about myself. And that's where I have to go and do the work. So it's possible for me to do that. Of course it's possible. But do I do it? That's only a question only I can answer for myself. That's the big issue. So theoretically, of course, we can all do this. But do we do it? That's a big question. So in answer, I would say the difference between whether I can think about doing it theoretically, because Rudolf Steiner found certain ideas, and now I understand them intellectually, my understanding is that's not doing it. So it's just understanding it as an idea. In order for me to do it, I have to bring that into my will. In order for me to bring it into my will to actually do what you just said of being able to choose that, I have to go through a kind of purification of my own feelings about myself and in the context of others. Am I getting enough energy? Am I getting enough attention? Is my life okay? Does this person remind me of something, someone I'm uncomfortable with? Or all of these feelings that are in me personally that give, that are permeated by a luciferic impulse. And a luciferic impulse is, at the end of the day, I win. At the end of the day, I'm going to win. That's the luciferic impulse. So I have to go into myself and ask, what is my motive for being in this? That's now the function of the I. The function of the will at the level of the I is to see the motive behind doing things. If I do that, then I can choose. If I don't do that, then I can't choose. Then I'm still, the level of will in the astral body, in the soul, is desire. The level of will in the I being is motive, according to Rudolf Steiner. And I have to practice to lift my will into motive, or else it immediately goes into desire. And then I can't choose. I am, the choice is already made based on pleasure. So, yes, you're correct, but do we do it? Only each person can answer that for themselves. So, theoretically, everything is possible, but in actuality, there needs to be a practice of dying to the lower self to awaken in the upper self. This has been since the very beginning of time, and this is then the spirit embryo. The sun. So if I can find that, then at least I'm aware that I'm projecting. If I can't find that, then I think the world is set against me. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but the guardian's there to tell you everything you think is set against you is actually coming from you. So the guardian's kind of a helper in helping us do that. So that's it's a really big question. But this is what Rudolf Steiner calls moral imagination. Can I, in myself, find how my feelings are moving? This is where desire comes in. Okay, so Sophia, the Achamoth, and Lucifer then get involved in the drama. Lucifer creates the belt of lies by permeating the sense activity, which really in the spiritual world was a kind of capacity to intuit what needed to be done next. The function of the senses was meant to be a kind of activity where the human could intuit what needed to be done next. But it got permeated by matter, and the senses themselves got permeated by matter when the physical body was born, and the Achamoth made the form of that, and that form is desire. So the senses were permeated by desire. And the biggest desire is to have the world be the way I want it to be. And this is a problem sometimes because I awaken and everything else is separate from me. And if it's raining or I wake up in the morning or there's a big snowstorm in Colorado and I have to take an airplane, I've got some problems. I've got a lot of desire going on in me. And then I start with inner pictures. And am I free to just go whatever? Probably not. So the drama unfolds because my senses have been permeated by matter. That's Lucifer's little world. The little world. And we call it the big world. But in that world of Lucifer, everything else is not me. And that mood of that is antipathy. One fundamental soul force. Everything in the world is not me. But there is, in the world, is the great me. That's Lucifer, pride, inflation. In the world is the great me, and then everything else is not me. So that's what Lucifer contributed to the soul. The Akamoth, through desire, was, well, everything's not me, but eventually it's going to be mine. Because, you know what? It's definitely mine. So this chair now is mine, and my pen is mine, and my car keys are mine, and all the oil underneath Saudi Arabia is mine. And
when I get this mastered, when I understand it,
it's mine, yeah. When you can finally get clear enough, dude, to explain it so that I can understand it, then it's mine. And then I'm happy. Okay, but until then, there's some antipathy. And so that antipathy, it creates in me impulse, like, why is he not making it so I can get it? That's bringing up feelings in me that I'm not so clear about, and antipathy. And that causes a force in me to get kicked in. We call it thinking. And then think I start because I've got an itch. Okay, this is, let's see. This, he said this, and he said that, and then this, and well, I'm not quite so clear about this, and click, 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 thinking. And every time I create a thought, that's antipathy. The great mystery is thinking itself is not antipathetic, because in the spiritual world, thinking and will are the same thing. But my thinking produces a thought. The chicken lays the egg. When the river slows down, the sandbar forms. When my thinking that is permeated with will slows down, a thought falls out of it. Just like the Akamoth fell out of the higher creation. A corpse falls out of my thinking and becomes a thought. The thought has very little will in it. Very little will in it. The thought has very little will in it. Why? Because it's already been thought. In order to understand something, I have to exert will. As soon as I understand it, the will goes away and I have the corpse of what I understand. So, on the side of the Akamoth, if I'm not in understanding, I'm searching for sympathy. I desire to know. And then when I desire to know, I look for symptoms that something is happening to me that's developing. My thinking keeps bringing things up, but my will keeps moving it and saying, this is not quite it, not quite it, not quite it, not quite it. And then I'm searching for a kind of development, and it's my will. But the crazy thing about it is my will is dark. It's hidden from me. My thinking I can kind of bring, because Lucifer wants to go, yeah, this is my gift to you. But the Achamoth is hidden in the desire to know, or to be, or to get, or to whatever.
The word understanding is a really interesting one to me, because I often turn it around to how you've used it, right? To stand underneath a mystery and take that tension, the paradox of, it's still a mystery to me, there's a yearning to understand it, but as soon as I've grasped it, formulated it, and said, now I got it, then it's no longer a mystery and it's dead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right, but that depends on how I approach the mystery. So if I approach the mystery intellectually, that's what happens.
Yes.
If I approach the mystery in a symbolic consciousness and learn how to work with experimentally with symbols, then the mystery stays intact even though I begin to get understanding. This is the difference between killing the cow and milking the cow.
Right.
Okay, so I need to develop a capacity in myself to be able to work with these things, to keep the mystery intact and still have it guide my soul towards my spirit. That's the work. Okay, so I wanted to bring this then, because this Lucifer Achamoth thing eventually ends up being thinking and will as a kind of impulse development. Between them then arises this third unknown factor of the feelings. And it's, if I wish to go through catharsis, my catharsis is that I have to explore my own feelings around the issues of thinking and will. And I have to do it by willing my thinking and thinking into my will. When I will my thinking, that's freedom. When I think into my will, that's love. When I think into my will, I see the motives for what I'm doing. And they allow me to have compassion on myself and others. When I control my thinking and guide it, I'm working towards freedom, because I can begin to make choices out of my true self rather than my personality. Okay, so let's take out the paper from yesterday, please. Okay, so what I'd like to do with you is a series of exercises, soul breathing exercises, where you can experience how the different faculties of thinking and feeling and willing operate around the realm of sense experience. So there is a process in working with your gaze, with how you look at things, where you begin to alter the habitual use of how you see things. So when I look at something, Rudolf Steiner gives the picture that my soul moves out from my body, moves towards the thing I'm trying to have a perception of, touches the thing I'm in a sense experience, and then comes back to me and gets linked to an idea that says, this is a car. And it happens just instantaneously. I have an inner recognition that I know what that is, I don't have to worry about it. Just goes click, click, and I have a picture and it's okay. If suddenly the car started to dance around by itself in the parking lot, I'd have to go and reshuffle things inwardly, because the percept was not meeting the concept in a way that I could understand. Right? So there's this process of taking from the world an image and then reflecting it back up. That reflecting it back up is called representation. I'm representing to myself something from the world, and once that image gets inside me, it can do its own thing. Can change into pizza pies if I'm hungry, or, you know, old movies that I saw, or remind me of people I know, or whatever. It has its own life depending upon my feelings. So I want to practice watching, and our first exercise will be a practice watching how my soul does this. It's kind of forming something. Because that's an analog for thinking. So I'm going to ask you to look at the picture in the upper left, figure two, in a special way. If I take my hands and I hold them out like this, and I put my attention on my fingers out here, I can find that I can watch, especially if I wiggle my fingers, I can look at my fingers out here and be aware of them, but what happens is my field of vision that normally wants to close and on something can't. I can become very active out here. I can hold my fingers out here and actually watch what they're doing. I used to do an experiment, we won't do it, where people move their arm out here. I'm looking at someone like this, but my attention is out here on the periphery. I can watch people move and stuff. It's very difficult for me to see faces out here, but big movements, yes. Even though my gaze is directed to a specific person. Physically. So your seeing is not where your eyes are focused, but where your attention is. I want to be able to make that distinction. So this process is called opening the gaze or softening the gaze. So I want you to look at the picture in such a way that you create a kind of space to the side where you soften so that the picture softens from being of something to just being a kind of pattern of light and dark. See if you can do that. If it's difficult for you to do that, then turn the image upside down. And then you kind of scramble its meaning. But I want you to look at the picture and then imagine that your gaze is slowly softening, so it just becomes a pattern of light and dark. Okay, is there any experience with this?
It grabs the feedback.
Yes. This is generally what happens when you go to soften, the gaze will and then collapse again. That's because our senses want to see something. My soul wants to see something. It gets very uncomfortable when it sees things that it doesn't get. Yes?
I don't feel so much the softening and grabbing. There is an intense desire for greater definition. I don't like where there's...
Oh, that's the grabbing.
Is that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Even if it's not a physical focus of the eye, it's
right.
The thought.
Oh, yeah.
Thought grabbing.
Right, it's a grabbing. This is thought. This is an analog of thinking. This grabbing, when it's all kind of, and then we grab, this is called thinking or forming a thought. So here in a sense experience, we have an analog of the thought process. I try to open it and become open to the thought, and I don't think so.
I'm very amused that in this softening process, my eyes are exhausted.
Oh, yeah. There, your soul resists this. Yes?
Continually, when I go to soften the image, I don't collapse back onto the image, but the image collapses into me.
That could be, yes.
And then I tend to forget out there and just want to look at it in here, but it's got no definition.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's... Is that the same sort of thinking?
Mm-hmm. So then we start to say, is that thinking or is that feeling? Okay, this is where we're going. So that we'll take this another step. I want you to soften. And this time, I want you to pay attention to where your gaze goes when it snaps back in. So soften, same picture, soften.
Figure two.
And then pay attention to where your gaze goes. Okay, where your gaze goes is the equivalent of a thought. Because there's some interest there for you. And when we're thinking, what we're doing is, Rinpoche Sutter said, meditation is like putting your head into an anthill. There's just all this potential of stuff, and then we choose something and we bring it in and it goes boonk and becomes that thing there that I'm really interested in. Now, I'd like you to look at the picture at the place where you find interest and really just kind of go into that place with your gaze. And now I'd like you to monitor how the rest of the picture goes away. So what I am interested in is where my soul goes. What I think I already know is what's comfortable to me. That's where I go. When I'm placed in a context of unknowing, read silence, I get very uncomfortable. And I want to fill the silence with either what I know or what I'm feeling or what I need to do now. This is a great drama of meditation. Oh, gee, I forgot. I got to call somebody. Oh, gee, I'm a little too busy this morning to do that. Oh, that's a great idea. I think I'll write it down. Yeah. So when the catharsis is in the silence. So if I wish to penetrate there, I have to watch myself collapse out of the silence or the openness of the potential. When I open my gaze, that's the pleroma. It's potential. And then suddenly, woo, out of the pleroma comes the Acamoth and the Lucifer drama and then the thing and oh yeah, and then I'm invested in it and this is how it is. And, oh my goodness, isn't this something? Or I'm not so comfortable, but I don't know about the feelings. Okay, so if you were to go into that space where you have interest, as we're going to go now, I want you to go to the place where you have interest. We'll call that a door. A door. It's a door to desire. Go to the door. And we're going to convert the area around the door into a feeling language. I'm going to ask you to not look at the thing that's in the door, the interesting area in your picture. Not, don't look at it, but look with it. And you look with it by following the movement of the shapes and curves inwardly as if you were kind of floating along with them or watching, moving with them. As you move with them, with your inner eye, try to monitor what feelings are arising in you out of that door. Okay, everyone understand where we're going? So take the area where you have interest. Imagine a kind of flow of energy as if there were water flowing through that area. How would the water move? And then replicate those movements in yourself as a kind of patterning and see if there are any feelings attached to them. Okay. One of the techniques of catharsis is translating artworks into movement And the movements carry a kind of uber language of feelings. And instead of just looking at it as a picture, I start to participate in a kind of flow of energies in the picture. That flow of energies has something to do with me, especially when I find a door that is interesting to me. Something in that area is expressing itself in a language of feeling to me that is speaking to me about something in myself. That's why I'm interested in it. And I want to take out of that interest, I want to extract from it a kind of essence of movement. Because the movement in my soul is more of a kind of flow of water. The thought is a kind of earth-forming quality. With my thought, I define something and fix it. And with my feeling, I flow with things, trying to say, does this flow, does it speak to me? How does it speak to me? How does this flow speak to me? And there's a deep, deep language in the flow of things, but I have to interpret the fixed nature of the picture in myself as a flow. As we go along, we'll get a little deeper in this. This is the work of Goethe in metamorphosis and morphology and phenomenology. Okay, so now we'll go to the third level. I'm going to ask you to look at the picture. And I'm going to ask you to imagine a block of stone. And go to the area where you have a door of interest. And I want you to imagine yourself taking pieces of stone away from that to reveal that form. I want you to try to imagine how that would be. I want you to look at the... We're working with the first one on the upper left.
Figure two.
Okay, so imagine with the Isis and Horus sculpture, imagine that around the place of interest, you can see what the space around the figure would look like. You want to go around the figure rather than seeing the figure. Okay, so what is around the figure is the negative space. And in a sculpture, the negative space is where the will of the sculptor was applied. And you're trying to see that as a kind of entity. The imagination of the sculptor had to think away the negative space in order to arrive at the form. And the nature of the will is very difficult to penetrate because it's dark. It's as soon as you try to penetrate it and shed some light on it, it becomes thought. So one of the ways of trying to block it or enter into the will is to try to enter into the process of the becoming by going into the space around things rather than the thing itself. It's a way of working to try to understand. Well, later we'll expand that. We'll expand the quality.
By Michelangelo, where he said, when he carved the David, I just took away everything.
Sure, sure. He was speaking as an esotericist. Sure, you have to just take away everything that prevents the image from forming. And it took will to do it. So the will is the hidden part of my thinking. So I will ask you, who when you did the exercise, who was it that guided your imagination? So when I have to explore will and separate it out, I have to begin to do things to my normal habitual sense expressions, to jam them, reverse them, block them, move them away from their habitual form, so I can see the nature of the will in them. Because there's two wills in every sense experience. There's my will that is filled with the Akamoth, and there is what Rudolf Steiner calls the ruling will that stands behind the becoming of the other thing. And my work is to learn which one is which. My will of the desire to have that thing look the way it is or whatever, that is just so unconscious in me. It's just a force that allows me to pay attention. But it's been grandfathered through time based on my feelings. And it creates a kind of, it substantiates or strengthens my experience of being separate from the sense object. But behind the sense object is what Rudolf Steiner calls the ruling will that created it. That, in order to explore that, I have to do something to my habitual sensing. That something that I do to explore the will nature of it is phenomenology.
What accentuates the perception of separateness?
My belief that it's out there. As a sense object. Because we say, well, duh, it is. Yeah? But it only is there as a sense object temporarily. In 20 years, it's going to be somewhere else. But we say, well, right now is the only thing that matters. Well, yes, right now. But there's another issue, is that right now keeps happening. And unfortunately, I've grandfathered a lot of stuff into it that I have to pay for. So just because I can dissolve the right myself into the right now doesn't mean I don't owe a debt. So the debt I owe, I have to find some way to pay it. And that means redeeming Lucifer. And the freeing Akamoth. So I have to go into the nature of my own will and find the difference between the ruling will that stands behind the sense phenomenon, how the sense phenomenon came to be, or what Goethe calls a becoming. How did that come to be? And then make a distinction between that will and the will I'm using to explore it. Eventually, if I can do that, I can find symbols that move in such a way in their ruling will that they teach me about my own will. That's symbolic consciousness. But I have to find this appropriate symbol that teaches me about my own will by monitoring my feelings in sense experience.
Can I come back to the world again? Doesn't the thing itself that I'm looking at, and what you meant by grandfathering, it itself has phenomenologically qualities that make up that symbol. It's not my symbol only.
That's correct.
It has a being in itself.
If it's a symbol. So, there's your glasses. Are they a symbol?
Partially.
Okay, so what's the difference between your glasses as something you use and the glasses as a symbol?
When I use them, I don't.
They're not particularly symbolic. But they could be. how could they become a symbol?
Would I want them to be? Would I really want them to be when I'm using?
Okay, you're avoiding the question.
So, I wouldn't have a world if I saw everything symbolic.
Well, the question, I wouldn't have a world that I'm separate from. I would have a world, but I would be participating in that world at another level. I would be becoming everything that I would think. That, according to Rudolf Steiner, that's the condition that I go into when I die. In the ancient world, they call that the realm of the ancestors. I become everything that was separate out here. The link between my condition here and that world is a symbol. But I have to take the mundane and I have to sanctify it with my own attentive will. Then it becomes a symbol. Otherwise, it's mundane. It can oscillate between being mundane and symbolic depending upon my intent. And that's the issue. So anything is a symbol and can be a symbol if my intent works with it in a symbolic way. If it's not, it's simply mundane. But when I lift something that's mundane into a symbolic content, I am freeing the Akamoth from the prison of Lucifer's belt of lies. Every time I do that.
Give an example of his glasses then.
The glasses represent a symbol for me going from a state of not being able to perceive to being able to perceive. Throw away your glasses and see how the world works for you. Whole other world. One of the biggest problems in the third world is people don't have glasses. It's true, because when they try to go and do work, ladies form co-ops for seamstresses, the old people can't participate because they can't thread a needle. They can't see. So we have glasses now that enable people to have economic independence. Wow, that's cool. So I could say glasses to a, if I went into a village with a truckload of glasses for old people and suddenly they could form a co-op to sew blankets together and make indigenous art, the glass would be a symbol of economic development. And
how
I could.
How does that free me from my glasses?
How's it what?
Looking at my glasses as a symbol, how does that free me from my glasses?
It's because if I can do that, then maybe one day when I pick my glasses up and just put them on, instead of just expecting that that's going to be there, I have a realization that there is much more behind this than just me putting them on. Now, I take that feeling and I amplify that to my car key. And then when I put my car key in the slot, it becomes a symbol of something else, doesn't it? Then when I point the finger, there's three pointing back. Of who's to blame? This is the symbolic world. Okay, so we are at time. Save your question. We'll start the next session with questions.